WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air at 12 minutes after 4, and this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. With me is Sybil Shepherd, who is well known for her roles in films like The Last Picture Show, The Heartbreak Kid, At Long Last Love, and Taxi Driver. Her major interest now is singing, mostly jazz standards, tunes by Cole Porter, Noel Coward, The Gershwins. She's been performing at clubs around the country, and this weekend she's in Philadelphia playing the Bijou. Before we speak with Sybil Shepherd, I thought we could listen to an excerpt of a session she recorded, I think a couple of years ago, with Stan Getz. This is not released on record, but we do have a copy of the tape with us. So this is Stan Getz and Sybil Shepherd. The song is Speak Low. Did you officially leave movies to sing, Sybil?
No.
You're still acting?
I want to still act. The last two parts I went up for, other people got them. But, you know, I figure if I go up for 10 parts and get one, I'm lucky. Besides that, if I do one film a year, and that's enough, you know? Because we don't live a real elaborate lifestyle. We don't have Rolls Royces.
We as you and your husband.
Mm-hmm.
And your baby, who's 9 months old.
Yes.
Why did you decide to be a club singer, to be a jazz singer, and go on the club tours?
Well, it started out when my father was teaching me to dance. He was a great jitterbugger, my mother and father. They had all these records, big band records, and of course that was the big band singers. They had Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and Joe Stafford, and, you know, Pete Fountain, Louis Armstrong, Rhapsody in Blue. So that was my first love, my father. You know, when you're 8, 9, 10-year-old girl, you're really kind of in love with your father. If you're lucky, maybe. And he was teaching me how to dance, and I love that music. So Then I got sidetracked into the Beatles, and which is great. You know, I really like their music and other things. And then I studied opera for 3 years, from say, 1971 to 74. And I really love opera. It's great for your voice, great exercise in building the voice. But people looked at me very strange when I sang opera. So also, you have to really dedicate your life to that because, you know, you can't really have another major career going at the same time because you have to study French, Italian, German, and work with the vocal coaches, the music coaches, you know. So, and I had the movie career, so I finally had to give that up. And I was just attracted to the Gershwin, the lyrics, the melodies are much more challenging than most songs, contemporary songs today. Challenging on another level, certainly.
Have you been able to use anything in that opera training in your jazz singing?
Yes, sure.
What applies from opera?
Well, first of all, you get the range. You certainly extend the range of your voice. You know, if you start out singing two octaves maybe and you really work, you can get to where you can do three. I've heard Cleo Lane has five octave range. I can't imagine, but, you know, it just gives you more keys to play with.
Since many people know you from your appearances in films, do you feel that when people find out you're a singer, they have preconceptions about what kind of singer you're going to be?
I think so. A lot of people come to look, and then their mouths usually, you know, they kind of drop off, and they drop open. They're so surprised that I can sing at all, you know. And then a lot of times they just start to enjoy themselves, I hope.
What kind of preconceptions do you think people have?
Well, they don't. I think they come just, they don't think I'll be able to sing at all. That's one of the big things.
I think when you're on stage as in a club singer, you're smaller in a way than when you're on a screen in a movie, since movie screens are so large, and you're very close to a singer in a small, intimate club. And you have such a different relationship with your audience now as a club singer than you do when you're on the screen.
Sure.
Are people not used to seeing you in that way, and how does that affect the way you relate to the people who come to hear you when you're performing?
Well, the big problem for me first was just how to relate, period, as myself to a live audience, because you don't have a character to work on and a character to be your facade or to become. You know, like even in the theater, I've done theater, and that's live. But again, you have that character. When you have to get up on the cabaret or on the small club, finally, I just concerned myself with communicating to the people that were in the audience and hoping that they would have an enjoyable experience and that I would have fun, too.
You have played a lot of roles that were characters who were very beautiful but manipulative women. Do you feel that the characters you've portrayed in movies have shaped the way people expect you to be like in real life as Sybil Shepherd?
I think so.
Do you have to work at undoing that, or when you meet someone, do you find that the way you act towards them is affected by the way they think you're going to be?
Oh, a lot of times, not so much the way I act towards them, because I don't have time or the inclination to be anything other than myself, you know, like day to day, whether it's an interview or whatever. But people, they do have preconceived ideas from those parts, I think, in movies, and sometimes they expect me to act a lot different than I am, so. But I don't worry about that too much.
How can you tell when someone's reacting to you based on your movies?
Well, they act too manipulative to me. For instance, I was in a case where somebody wanted me to sing on a television show, and no one had told me ahead of time that they wanted me to sing, and I had no piano player or anything. But the girl on the telephone said to me, well, you've got to sing, you've got to prove to everyone that you can sing. And she just sort of right off the bat, well, if she knew me, she would never say anything like that, I don't think. I think she'd just say, why don't you come sing? You know, and most of the time I'll sing anywhere, any place, you know, if somebody really wants to. But the minute somebody says, okay, you've got to sing, you've got to prove, you know, and I told her I don't have to do anything but die.
Outside of the people who have gotten your album that's available through mail order, the only singing people I've heard you do is in the film At Long Last Love, which I've never seen. But I know it wasn't a very successful movie.
No, it certainly wasn't.
Did that have negative effects on your singing career?
Mm-hmm. It's been quite an obstacle.
Has your singing changed a lot since the making of the movie?
I hope so. I know so.
Let's listen to another recording from the session that we have with Stan Getz. Now, when was this made? About 4 years ago?
4 or 5 years ago. That's correct. He saw Daisy Miller, as a matter of fact. I ran into him at a screening of a film that I did, Daisy Miller. He came up out to after the screening. He said, oh, Daisy. And I said, you look awfully like Stan Getz. And he said, oh, yes, baby. So I said, well, I'd like to do an album with you. He said, anytime. He said, just give me a call.
So that's how you got to record this? How come it's not released?
I don't know. People don't want it. I don't know. The record companies, it doesn't... I haven't clicked. I'm just beginning. My recognition or any small bit of being taken seriously is just beginning for me, and it's been a long time, you know. So for years that I would submit this to the record companies, they don't know where to fit it. You know, they just think, well, she's an actress, and this is not country western. This is not pure, not for the jazz purists, you know. So what is it? And since they can't figure out what it is, they don't buy it.
Is that what accounts, do you think, for you not being taken seriously?
Well, I think a certain amount of that would just come naturally from my... It would appear that I would not be very serious because of the massive publicity that came along with films like At Long Last Love. Well, you know, a lot of times interviewers, they ask you questions, and the answers that you give them so often end up fitting with what they want to believe. And, you know, I can talk myself blue in the face about how serious I've been about music, but no one's going to write it down, you know, until something turns around. And finally, with the Phineas Newborn album that I did, that's happening.
Let's go back and listen to the Stan Getz album. Well, as we're listening to this, should we be thinking that that's how you sound now? Do you sound different now? It's 4 years later?
Completely different.
Can you describe the difference?
I hope I'm better.
Okay.
Don't we all?
Yeah. Well, okay, this isn't Never Entered My Mind. We'll be hearing Sybil Shepherd singing along with Stan Getz.
You say that I be playing solitaire, uneasy in my easy chair. It never entered my mind. Once you told me I was mistaken, that I'd awaken with the sun and order orange juice for one. It never entered my mind. You have what I prayer again, and wish that you were there again to get into my hair again. It never entered my mind.
Thank you.
sweet alone. The man who came to dinner lets me eat alone. I confess it, I didn't guess it, that I would sit and mope again. And all the while I'd it never entered my mind.
Into a very hard thing right now, because no one really sells records singing jazz standards. I wonder how many records Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald
somebody
sell
told me
singing
once
standards.
That if a jazz record sells 20,000, it's a hit.
I think that's true.
Mm-hmm, so that if that's why so many of the major labels, I mean, they're not interested in a lot of people, you know, because of that.
Do you expect to make money with a singing career doing standards?
Well, I know I'm not making money now. I don't know. I don't know. I don't really expect to make a lot of money.
Mm-mm. But you love it, and that's what you're doing.
Yes, I don't really know what else to do either, and it comes natural. And I love these songs. They're just natural to me, you know.
You're touring now. Do you like touring?
Oh, it's exciting. It's wonderful. The different reactions that you get, you know, some just incredibly negative things where people say things like, well, fortunately, she still looks like a model. And then you get, on the other hand, these where people are just starting to take me seriously, and I've gotten some just really encouraging reviews and constructive criticism. See, with movies for so long, I would get bad reviews. I never would read them because what is the point? You can't change that film. It's done. It's locked away, right? Permanent. But with performing, reviews can be very helpful. And I found that, you know, so we read most of the reviews and sift through and, you know, try to figure out really what's legitimate. And then of course, there's no point in reading those entirely negative, personal, you know, things like that. They're sort of funny, really. Like I remember someone said about At Long Last Love, that I couldn't walk or talk, much less sing. Well, we found that to be amusing. Anyway.
What's an example of some good advice or criticism that you've gotten from reading a review?
Let's see, where do I begin? Relating to the audience, that I could use my acting more to relate to the audience.
What do you think of that? You know, I always feel a little distanced when a singer does an act during the talking intervals as opposed to just speaking directly to the audience.
Well, I do too, and what I do isn't really even an act, period, because it's a number of songs with I talk to the audience, and we hope create a mood and have a good, really nice time. But as far as heavy drama and, you know, no, I have to leave that to somebody else. But a lot of times you can take somebody's criticism and really turn it around and see it. With me, what I have to overcome is, say, first night terror, which a lot of people always experience all their life. I will often appear to be incredibly cool on the surface and become cold, as opposed to, so I lose my contact with the audience. So I turned that criticism about using my acting around to really mean, well, to continue to try to reach or to connect or to bring in the audience to you, you know, instead of being try to avoid that cold exterior. Sometimes you can. I mean, sometimes I'm just so terrified. Like in Chicago, this past gig, the first night was just a disaster because I was so incredibly terrified. Mm-hmm. The second night was great, though. I got better and better after that.
Good. Can we talk a little bit about your movies, Sybil?
Sure.
What's the, of the movies you've done, which are your favorites?
I used to like them all, you know, I like them for about 6 months after I do them, and then it becomes a process of everyone I see them. Well, I don't know. Sometimes I like them, sometimes I don't. I don't have one favorite.
I'd like to talk a little bit about my favorite, which is Taxi Driver.
Okay.
How did you get involved with that film?
Well, I think that the director, Martin Scorsese, hadn't seen or hadn't heard of it, Long Last Love, and that's the only reason he cast me. Right at that time was the stuff was hitting the fan with Long Last Love, and I was in New York, and I mean, it was bad news. And for some reason, I think maybe I'm not giving Scorsese enough credit, but I just think he didn't know all that was happening. I think I don't know. But I kind of walked in and was just myself, so he said I go back. I remember another story. Someone called the agency that I was with and said, we want someone like Sybil Shepherd. And so my agency, the agent at the time, said, well, how about the real thing? And the man, the producer, said, well, there's no money, which there wasn't for that film up front. So I got a percentage of the gross, tiny, 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 tiny. But I did make good money on it.
You play someone in that movie who is working on a presidential campaign.
Correct.
Working with Albert Brooks and
Yes.
The taxi driver, played by Robert De Niro, watches you, just double parks and watches you through a large glass window in your office while you're working and develops this enormous crush on you and invites you out for some coffee and invites you to a movie. Your reading of the character, how would you want us to relate to your character in that?
I couldn't possibly say. I think I'd want people to relate to it in an infinite number of ways. It depends on what you've had for dinner before you see the film. Another director, Ivan Passer, who's brilliant, and I worked with him on a film called Silver Bears, he said, you know, every time the movie's different every time you see it.
Have you ever met anyone similar to the Travis Bickle character, the taxi driver? Have you had an experience like that in your own life that was similar?
Oh, yes, a lot of weirdos around.
Did you draw on that in the movie?
Mm-hmm. I had to, it was very easy just to simply respond to De Niro. I didn't have to draw anything. Someone once said, Cagney, I think, said it. Or Bogart, might have been Bogart, said, just stand up straight, look the other guy in the eye, and tell the truth. And I think that's a pretty good acting thing right there. There is a lot of emphasis, like I know Strasberg and some people, about pulling out one's emotional thing, and I think that sometimes it's too much internal, and that often I get a lot from externals, like how I end up being costumed, how the sets are, what's in the drawer of my bedroom on the set. Stroheim was a great stickler for detail like that, and that helps me a lot, certainly as much as the internal. There is a point, of course, where you have to have the internal, too.
What about Martin Scorsese? What kind of direction did he give you?
He did a real interesting thing with improvisation because he filmed it, videotaped it. He videotaped us all improvising all our scenes endlessly. Then he went back over after we were gone, picked out the lines he liked, and typed them up in a script. And we got that script, you know, ahead of time, and we had those set lines. But that was a real interesting way to work. None of the lines that I said in Taxi Driver were in the original script. It was undoable, that script, my part in that script. Matter of fact, I threw it across the room and burst into tears saying, what a horrible, stupid part. But, of course, De Niro and Scorsese, I knew something interesting would come up.
Does that happen frequently, that you're given lines that you just don't think are going to
work? All the time.
But you
every picture.
You can't always
except
rewrite
for
it, though, huh?
Well, I tell you something. I've always rewritten them with someone, except for one picture, and it was the worst thing I've done. And I was in a situation for the first and only time, I hope that this ever happens again, where the writer was set in his ways, and there wasn't time to sit down and, you know, go through and find out what works. You know.
Did the other characters, the other actors in the movie feel the same way about their lines, like De Niro and Albert Brooks?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Yeah, we were all improvising. But things like The Heartbreak Kid, see, that was written by Neil Simon based on Bruce J. Friedman's short story. Now, he had it in his contract that we couldn't change a word, but it was brilliant. And Elaine May, as a way of approaching it, we improvised and then came back to the script. And that was the first time I'd ever improvised. It was with Elaine May. That was my second picture.
Well, Paul Schrader was the person who wrote the script for Taxi Driver. Mm-hmm. Do you think he was personally offended or very angry when people
when it was
started...
such a success?
No, when you all did away with his script, when you used different dialogue than the one he had written.
I don't know. You know, I never saw him during this period.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally did see him later on at a party or something. He didn't look me in the eye. I don't know. He hasn't cast me in any of his pictures. Not that I would do him.
Why not?
Oh, I don't know. I don't like him much.
Some people had strong objections to the violence in Taxi Driver.
I did.
How come?
I'm a chicken. I don't like seeing it. I'm a real chicken liver when it comes to that.
You know, Taxi Driver is an example of a movie where a lot of people who go see it turn their heads because they don't want to see...
Like me, I have my face and turn my head. I leave the theater.
What about when you're on the set? Because certainly on the set...
Well, see, I wasn't around for any of those scenes.
Oh, you weren't. Have you ever been around on a set for
when they
for the
violence?
Kind of violent scene that if you were in the theater, you'd have to turn your head away for?
Yeah, but you see, it never looks like that because it's all a little bitty. Most of the time, any kind of violence or action is a little, especially if it's any good, will be lots of small cuts. Like the scene, the obvious example being that scene in Psycho where Hitchcock has in, I don't know how many, 30 seconds, 150 cuts, or I don't know what it is, you know, but an enormous amount of cuts.
So when you see the whole film of Taxi Driver, do you like it?
I think it's a good movie, yeah. I do. I think he's a talented director, and she's an awfully good actor.
Was it interesting to work with Robert De Niro? Did you learn anything from watching him go through the part? I thought that was a really brilliant role.
He was great. He was totally the part. He hardly spoke on the set. No light, no small talk. Did I learn anything from him? It's just great. I'm sure just great working with such great actors, you know. I can't think of anything specific.
Is it hard to work with a bad actor?
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Doesn't give you anything to work from?
The hardest thing in film is if an actor won't, like off camera, on the off camera parts when it's your close up, if that actor is not really giving you, you know. And a lot of times actors, you know, they get off camera and they just look the other way and say the lines, you know. That happens. But most of the time it doesn't. I found actors and actresses to be, most of them to be really great.
Is it exciting to shoot a movie or is it boring because you have to shoot the same lines over from five different angles and do a lot of different
takes? I love doing movies, but and I'm not bored by those things because I expect that, but I love doing theater and live work too because you don't have to do it over and over again. And it's easier in a way. It's easier.
Well, you usually go with a director's suggestion if their suggestion for playing a scene is a little different than yours, or do you really want to try it your way?
Well, I will discuss it. I want to usually do a lot of discussion, but in the final analysis, I will always do it with the director. There's been a couple of times where there were some really bad lines in a picture, and I just didn't say it.
You can't say a bad line.
But most of the time,
very hard.
It wasn't a dirty line, it was just a stupid line.
Do you remember a line that was just too bad to say?
Yeah. It was this one in a movie I did, Special Delivery. The line was something like, I don't even remember. I blocked it out.
You recently did a remake of The Lady Vanishes, the Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever a remake comes out, you say to yourself, gee, why are they remaking the film when the original still exists?
Well, that's just people are short-sighted when they say that. They don't realize, they're not thinking. They're not thinking far enough back. Their sense of history is lacking.
Did everyone from the cast and the director sit down and talk about how this was going to supposed to be similar to or different from the original?
Well, when I say sense of history, it's like Hamlet was a remake, you know.
Of what?
Of another play. Same play. Same story. It had already been done as a play. And the very famous actor who Shakespeare wrote most of his major parts for at that time, I can't remember his name, but he's very famous, historical figure, said, found it in a trunk. Found this old play and said, why don't you redo that? I'd like to play that part. So Shakespeare redid it. Verdi's Otello is a remake of Shakespeare's Othello, and I'm sure none of Shakespeare's. You know, and finally, there's stories that are done. The Lady Vanishes is based on a book by Ethelina White called The Wheel Spins, which is a very well-written book, and it's a new adaptation. It's not a remake. It's a new adaptation written by George Axelrod, who wrote Seven-Year Itch and did the adaptation of Bus Stop. So it's like two different viewpoints. I don't really think of it as a remake of a Hitchcock picture. I don't think it has anything to do with that. I think it's a new adaptation of The Wheel Spins by Ethelina White.
Mm-hmm. Did you nevertheless make a point of either seeing or not seeing The Lady Vanishes?
I saw it, yeah. I wouldn't have done it if they were remaking Vertigo, but I shouldn't say that because I think remakes are perfectly all right. See, I don't think it's not a question of remakes. I think that somebody's gotten that word in there and that's not the right word.
Well, when you're using the same title as another movie, what other word can you use?
Well, Hamlet. You don't call Hamlet a remake.
Well, everyone
hadn't. You don't call Othello, because Verdi used the same title as Shakespeare. You don't call it a remake. He's not remaking it. He's doing it from a different point of view. It's a new adaptation.
Are you happy with the movie?
It's okay. I think it's a nice film.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sybil Shepherd. And Sybil, I think we'll listen to another selection from your recording with Stan Getz. And again, this is from a tape that they made together about 4 years ago. The next song we're going to hear is The Masquerade is Over.
Both afraid to say we're just too
That was Leon Russell's song, This Masquerade, and we heard Sybil Shepherd singing along with Stan Getz in a session recorded about 4 years ago. Sybil, who are some of the other musicians featured on there?
Well, Frank Rossellino is going to be on the next cut. I think you're going to play. He's on trombone. And then Oscar Castro Nevish, who did all of Sergio and still does all of Sergio Mendez's arrangements. He did the arrangements on this and plays guitar. Terry Trotter on piano. Monty Budwig on bass. And there are other people, but I can't remember who.
Okay. Let's get back to talking a little bit about some of the movies that you've been in. Let's talk a little bit about The Heartbreak Kid, which was directed by Elaine May, written by Neil Simon. You said that you learned a lot about improvisation through working with Elaine May.
That was the first time I ever improvised.
Uh-huh.
We improvised away from the script, and then we just to explore the meaning of the lines, start to the lyrics.
How do you do that? How do you explore the meaning of the lines without getting overwrought?
Well, you just think, like, I'd like to go swimming, and try to figure out how you can say that in using other words with the same meaning.
Did she...
That's all improvisation is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in that particular situation. So can you think of another way to say, let's go swimming? Have the same meaning but use different words.
Sure, there's probably hundreds of ways to say it.
Right. So just by exploring that, by saying, I'm so hot. Ugh, I'd like to get wet. Right?
So would you tape it and see how it looked, or just throw out the lines and see
no,
how they were
No taping or anything. We just did it in a room, and just purely for the exercise of doing that.
Did she have a good sense of timing?
Oh, yeah, she's great. She said one of the great pieces of direction, she said, act when you say something, expect the person you're speaking to listen. Which is good.
In movies or in life, too?
Oh, no, just in acting.
Uh-huh. So what does that mean when you're acting? How does that translate?
I don't know. Try it and you'll see.
Okay. Was she very funny on the set?
Charles Grodin made her laugh a lot. I didn't think he was funny then. It took me about 3 years before I ever laughed at Charles Grodin. I don't know why that is. Maybe I needed a little maturity or something.
In many of your movies, your hair is really, you know, styled, or you're very...
Is it?
Well, no, not...
Not really.
Not really, but... No, it's not really styled, but there's a certain glamour within the movies. The glamour,
think,
not of a...
I think it comes more from the lighting than it does come from the hairstyle.
From the hairstyle.
Because lighting is what makes people look good and might look, if you will, glamorous. I believe that sometimes... I think people should look... It depends on the part, really.
What I'm getting to, I think, is okay. That you're wearing maybe a teeny little bit of lipstick now, but no makeup, and your hair's combed recently. It's certainly not done. Mm-hmm. It's not highly styled. Your sunglasses are sitting on top of your head. Do people expect when they see you that you're a very glamorous styled person who's
well,
gonna be wearing
wants
a lot of
me
makeup
to. And my mother wants me to. She's constantly telling me, you walk around here, you need to look like a movie star when you go to the grocery store, because people expect that. And I can't get it together. I cannot get it together. I wear the same pair of jeans, you know, and it's not my thing. I don't know. I can get it together in terms of clothes and things. I can get it together for a part, you know, character. That's fun. That interests me. You know, I get into that. But as far as looking glamorous, I am just...
Well, I
admire people that can do it, you know. That's a thing, but...
I think a lot of...
It takes too much time.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time to get that together.
Some
and
people
I was
see
paid
the...
to do that, see, as a model. And it was so boring, but the money wasn't boring. But you get paid to do your makeup. You get paid to do your hair and all that. So then when you're not being paid, you sort of do the simplest thing and keep it simple, you know.
The old stereotype of the glamorous stars, that if they didn't have time to put on the makeup and the clothes, they wouldn't go out, because there is that image that you have to keep up.
Those times are gone.
Are they gone?
I wish they weren't to some extent, because at least in that period, I would have been working a lot more than I am now. Now that kind of, now it's almost better not to, I mean, it's easy to get a part in Charlie's Angels if you look a certain way, but it's hard to get other interesting parts sometimes when you look, when you say, quote, you know, pretty girl or whatever. Especially if you've done any of those posters and things, but I've avoided that.
Oh, the posters like Farrah Fawcett Majors.
Of course, I'd be rich if I'd done them. I'd be a millionaire too, right? I could do all the albums I wanted. But then if I'd done all those things, I wouldn't have had time to work. I mean, on music and stuff.
You're living in Memphis now?
Well, that's our home, but we have to spend a lot of time, you know, of course, everywhere. L.A., we stay in Santa Monica when we're in L.A.
How do the people in your hometown in Memphis relate to you?
Great. You know, they're just, I have a lot of family, so mostly it's family. I have a vast family. They're great. They helped me tremendously. It took me 10 years, though, to go back to that. Because for 10 years, I think I went through that rejection thing. Maybe it's part of a prolonged adolescence.
Do you get recognized a lot in the cities that you're performing in?
Depends. I go through, if I have a piece in the newspaper come out in Memphis, people will have a heightened awareness of who I am maybe for 2 weeks, and then it dies down. It's amazing. I just hope I never have to live behind gates again. There was a period where I lived in Bel Air. Those people that have to live like that with barbed wire on top of their fences, I feel sorry for that. I mean, they have no freedom. The only restaurants they can go out to are the restaurants in Beverly Hills where the maitre d's and everybody's really cute into, you know, who they are and not letting people. But that's, I don't think that's any way to live.
Why did you have to do that? Because you would have been swamped by fans if they knew where you were? Or if they had access to you?
Well, not really. I just, at that point, did live in a house that had those gates.
Do you like being recognized?
Sometimes, and sometimes I'd rather not.
What type of approach really bothers you when someone's going to come up to you?
I know one that bothers me. When someone comes up and says, are you Cheryl Teagues?
I can understand why that would bother you. So what are your plans for the near future?
Near future. I'm going to be here at the Bijou Cafe tonight and tomorrow night. That's fun. After that, there's an all-star jazz band that's going to be getting together in at the University of Mississippi with a lot of real nice musicians, and I'm going down there. I'm going to be the vocalist, Mose Allison, and myself are the vocalists.
Well, I hope you enjoy it. Good luck with your future. Thanks for being here, Sybil.
I loved it. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Sybil Shepherd, who you probably know from her many movie roles. She's in Philadelphia now singing at the Bijou Cafe. Her repertoire is mostly jazz standards, a few more contemporary numbers. She sings songs by Cole Porter, Rodgers and Hart, the Gershwins, Kurt Weill. She'll be performing at the Bijou tonight and tomorrow night with two sets both nights.